Well, thanks, Juan and Peter, for inviting me. I was a little surprised I got invited to this workshop in the first place. And I sent Peter a title because he needed a title. And I remember the workshop had something to do with adaptation and species interactions and movement. But I kind of put the words together in a different order. So I had local adaptation with interacting species that moved. So I know that a lot of people are vying for position as the greatest outlier of the group. I think I might have an argument for that, because I'm going to be talking about, well, you'll see, I'm talking about a problem in the area of coevolution. And I think what Peter convinced me of in my almost near reluctance to talk about this is that it'll be interesting to think about the implications of adaptive movement on the conclusions I'm going to talk about, which involve no adaptive movement whatsoever. So what I'm going to do is talk about this new work that I've done with a couple of collaborators, and then at the end, maybe we can discuss how a consideration of adaptive movement and actually many of the other issues, that interesting issues that have been brought up here, might impact some of those conclusions, which are relevant for actually a large community of evolutionary biologists, namely coevolutionary biologists. So I want to focus in on the issues of what kinds of correlations develop between interacting species across the spatial scale. Before I go on, I want to make sure that I acknowledge my collaborators, Scott Neusmer, the University of Idaho, who's actually the senior author on this study, and then Ben Ridenour, who was Scott's former postdoc and is now at the CDC. So let me just kind of lay out the issue I'm going to talk about here for the next however many minutes before I actually broach the subject of adaptive movement. I'm going to talk about what kinds of patterns coevolution tends to produce. Okay. So, but before I even talk about that, I want to make sure that I'm very clear about the definition of coevolution that I'm using, and the definition here is actually quite narrow. It goes back to Janssen, and he published this paper called When Is It Coevolution? Back in 1980. I'm going to adopt that definition, not because I necessarily think it's the best, and I guess it's arguable, but it's very specific. And specifically by evolution, what I mean is joint adaptive evolution in response to reciprocal interspecific selection. So you have to have species with mutual effects on one another's fitness, but that's not enough. They also have to have heritable genetic variation that allows them to respond to that mutual selection. Okay, so that's the definition I'm going to focus on, because a lot of people are trying to just see how much coevolution is going on out there in the world, what kinds of coevolution are going on, and so forth. So one idea that has been floating around for a long time is that if species are co-evolving, mutually affecting one another, then they ought to have some correlation between traits that are involved in the interaction. A moth that pollinates a plant should have an abdomen length that corresponds pretty closely to the corolla depth. Okay, and so you should see maybe a positive correlation in that situation between these two characteristics. And so, and you can think about other kinds of interactions like exploiter-victim, where you might expect a negative correlation and so forth. So the kind of conventional wisdom here is correlations should be strong indicators of coevolution, and in fact, When you see, go out and document spatial correlations among traits of co-occurring species, it's often thought that those correlations are due to coevolution. Okay? So, of course, in 1980, Janssen wrote a very eloquent note that basically pointed out that that is definitely not the case. There's a lot of other reasons why species can have either positive or negative correlations in the traits that are possibly involved in an interaction that have nothing to do with the definition of coevolution that I presented earlier on. And basically, his ideas were that if you go out and find a certain hummingbird pollinating, and you find that it tends to respond very strongly to red colors, and it's, you go out and you find it pollinating a red flower, like in this picture here, that doesn't mean that the hummingbird and the plant have co-evolved. It could be that the hummingbird evolved its visual system for maybe with respect to a totally different plant species, just happened to come into this area where it was predisposed to respond to red coloration, and boom, you see a pollinator that tends to respond to red pollinating a plant that is red. Okay, so there's no coevolution there. It's just kind of a pre-existing bias that's there. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that species can have mutual effects on each other's fitness, but there's no genetic variation in one of the species that's interacting, so that maybe a certain host type is just going to get hammered by whatever parasites it encounters, but it has no genetic variation to evolve resistance. So this is a case of so this is another sort of case where you could see interactions in terms of affecting fitness, but there's no true coevolution because the host species could not evolve. It doesn't have any genetic variation to respond to the getting hammered by the parasites and so forth. So Janssen made this argument, you know, almost 30 years ago, and you'd think that, those were very good points and all, but in recent times, you know, in the last decade or so, there's been a resurgence of interest amongst coevolutionary biologists in using spatial correlations between traits of species to try to infer coevolutionary process. And part of this interest has been spurred on by John Thompson's geographic mosaic theory of coevolution, who has painted a broad picture of coevolution varying from place to place in space, varying in nature, being connected by gene flow and being affected by genetic drift and so forth. So one of John's predictions is that you expect to see like trait matches and mismatches at various places along a spatial extent. And so people who are interested in testing this theory thought that you could look at patterns of covariation amongst different species and try to see these patterns of matching and mismatching and so forth, use it as evidence maybe to support or refute the geographic mosaic theory. So there's this interest amongst empiricists in these trait correlations and relating them to now a more complicated process of coevolution. However, there's never really been a maybe the word rigorous is too strong, but there's never been a real quantitative an attempt to put the connection between coevolution and correlation on a quantitative basis. Okay. So that's what I want to talk about here today, and then we can talk about how adaptive movement might affect the results. So I've got a number of different objectives then. One is to simply quantitatively justify Janssen's very reasonable arguments. I mean, I almost think they don't really require quantitative treatment, but we'll get that in the wash, or maybe there's some bit of logic that he missed. Anyway, so that's one of the, although I don't, you'll see that he didn't. I want to go beyond that too with this study. I want to look at more specific questions, like maybe there are some types of interactions between species, maybe mutualistic or maybe exploiter-victim or maybe competitive interactions that always do lead to certain correlations, okay? So that's something we want to explore. And maybe they always overwhelm other causes of correlation. An important one that Janssen pointed out is that there could be aspects of the environment that just support similar traits in species, like very nutrient-rich environments might support large body size in species that co-occur there, even if they don't affect one another's fitness at all. They just happen to both be large in places where there's a lot of resources and both be small in places where there aren't very many, and they don't interact at all. So the question is, will that be overwhelmed by certain kinds of interspecific interactions? And then I also want to look at the reverse question of, can we use the absence of a correlation to infer the absence of coevolution? Because that then would make correlation be a useful way to reject a null hypothesis of coevolution. And then the last thing is I wanted that we were aiming at was to try to actually put some quantitative predictions on patterns of spatial correlation that you would have in the absence of a geographic mosaic process. And then you can use that as a set of null expectations to test a geographic the presence of a geographic mosaic. So we want to, that's kind of the agenda here. Okay, so how did we accomplish this? Well, we looked at the simplest kind of interaction involving just two species, and we assumed a system where these two species are co-distributed across a large number of sites, basically an infinite number of sites, but at any particular site, both populations are finite in size, okay? You'll notice here that I'm not saying anything more about population size than this, okay? And this, I think, sets my talk apart from anybody else's in this workshop. So it's been all about the population dynamics here. And I think a big limitation of what I'm going to talk about is that there's absolutely no population dynamics. They're just fixed sizes. But they are there. We're not assuming infinite population size. And this will bring up another evolutionary process of random genetic drift and how it could affect patterns of covariation among traits. Okay, we assume that there's both sources of abiotic and biotic selection that are simultaneously acting at all these different sites. We assume that there's that the response to both abiotic and biotic factors depends on a couple of quantitative traits. It could be, you know, abdomen length and corolla depth, for example, in the two different species. I'm going to call those Z1 and Z2. They're quantitative genetic traits, and I'm going to, for some of the talk, go into a place called Landy Land, where quantitative trait modeling is very similar to, I think, studying the evolution of clones. It's mathematically convenient, but we actually go beyond that as well. The point is, they're quantitative traits. And we also allow there to be covariation in the traits that are favored for abiotic reasons across this space. Okay, the high nutrient level leads to maybe favoring large body size for both species. Low nutrient levels favoring small body size for both species, okay, irrespective of the biotic interaction. So we allow there to be covariation because one of Janssen's ideas is that, in fact, the similarity in requirements for matching the abiotic environment between species could be a very, very strong factor that leads to strong correlations among species, irregardless of coevolution. That was the idea. So we allow for that. The finite population size I already mentioned allows us to include random genetic drift. And then here's the movement part, which actually, I have to be honest, we added as an afterthought. We added the dispersal or movement in when we realized it wasn't going to make the equations any more difficult to analyze for these covariance patterns. So we also allowed then there to be gene flow among sites, and it's going to be the kind of complete mixing model that Bob Holt was talking about in the last talk of that sort. Okay, so let me just go through in a little bit more detail some of the elements of the model. So I mentioned that both of the species that we're following are subject in any particular site to abiotic selection, selection that's aside from the interaction, and we assumed a model that's commonly used in quantitative genetics, this Gaussian fitness function, and we assume that there's some optimum that will be called theta, theta 1 for species 1, theta 2 for species 2, that tells you where, what phenotype gives you the maximal fitness. There's a parameter gamma here that basically governs how quickly you fall off in fitness as your phenotype deviates from that optimum. Okay, this is more of a strategic sort of quantification of fitness, but it's often used in conceptual terms. It can actually describe a whole lot of different sorts of selection you might imagine, including directional selection and stabilizing selection. So I mentioned that the abiotic environments for the two species we allow to be correlated to one another, and the way we modeled that was to assume that the two optima follow a bivariate distribution, normal distribution, with some, there should be bars on top of these, with some mean, and then a variance-covariance structure indicated by that. Okay, so there, we're going to leave that pretty arbitrary. Although the different sites vary in their optima, they don't, over space, they are fixed temporally. Okay, so in any location, the species will actually approach that abiotic optima, but since the optima don't change, that's what allows species to track their abiotic environment. Of course, that's going to be potentially countered by interspecific interactions. But that's part of the model. The abiotic selection, I mentioned that we wanted to consider a whole variety of different kinds of species interactions, ranging from mutually beneficial to exploiter-victim to competitive interactions. So for the biotic selection, we employed a couple of different models. One's called a phenotypic matching model, where the fitness consequences of an interaction between two species depend on how well the two traits we're focusing in on match one another. So if the species benefits from the match, like a parasite would match, if it matched its host in some characteristics, it would get a maximal benefit. And then if it didn't match, then its fitness would drop off according to another one of these Gaussian curves. For the species, if the species were being harmed by the interaction, then having a greater match would lead to lower fitness, but you would get improved fitness if you mismatched either above or below. So this corresponds to what Peter has called a bidirectional axis of vulnerability, which I think is one of the coolest terms I've ever heard. Okay. We also, so that would correspond maybe to, here's a cuckoo egg that would be effective as a parasite strategy to the extent that it matches these eggs here, that it's a nest the nest it's parasitizing. Okay, that's an example. Maybe even this hawk moth and orchid interaction as well. Okay, but we also wanted to consider situations which Peter's described as unidirectional axes of vulnerability, where you only get the benefit if you are exceeding the species you're interacting with in some way. So a good example is here, if this garter snake had a gape that was too small, it would get absolutely no benefit from eating the new, actually maybe it would because it wouldn't get poisoned, but on the other hand, it could eat a lot more prey if its gape was larger and larger. So that we modeled using functions that look like this, whether the species got a benefit or was harmed by the interaction. So we wanted to explore these different kinds of interactions, not just the type, mutualistic, competitive, exploiter-victim, but also the way that fitness was determined, bidirectional or unidirectional axes of vulnerability. So we're trying to do a whole lot of things because any one of them might contribute more or less to these correlations amongst traits. Okay, we wanted to see what the effects were. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, so I mentioned, oh yeah, go ahead.
You don't have a no model in there in a way, do you? I mean, they're all kind of variant curves that presume kind of relationship of some sort, but I mean, is there a null? I mean, a flat line?
A completely neutral model then? We could do that, but the neutral model just has no correlation. That's right. Yeah. Exactly. So they could be potentially affecting both. We have our parameters, though, so that we can actually turn one of them off. So we can turn off biotic selection in both one or both species and see what the pattern would be with just abiotic selection alone. That really, in a sense, is our null model, or one of them. Or we can then tune up we were able to tune up this phenotype matching and turn off the what we call the phenotype differences model, so we could explore those different ones. So, yeah.
Just for clarity, can you say how your model where only one species is evolving and the other one isn't would fit into this?
It doesn't actually fit into this. We put that in by just making the added it, the heritable variance for the trait involved be zero. And then there's no way it can evolve in this model.
For one of the
species, yeah. We actually didn't look at that situation because there's already enough material here without that, but we could do that quite easily, yeah. So let me get to just the last two processes. I mentioned random genetic drift, and this is going to depend on the local population sizes, which we assumed were both fixed in time and also uniform across space for each of the species, although they could be different in the two species. Okay. And basically, the effect of drift is to have no change, no expected impact on the change in the traits of either species, but it does lead to a variance in the change, and that depends on G sub I. That is the additive genetic variance, it's the heritable genetic variance for the trait, divided by N. This is essentially the sampling variance of the mean breeding value, and this is a result that Russ Landy published a long time ago in the 70s to look at the evolution of a single quantitative trait. We're just extending it here to a couple of interacting species. Okay. So that's how the drift comes into play. It has an expected value of zero, but it can contribute to variation and covariation across space because it tends to cause differences in different localities, okay, all by itself, even though the average difference is zero. And then finally, we adopted this very simple model of dispersal, the Wright's Island model, where each of the different sites contributes migrants at a fraction mi per site to some giant pool of migrants here, and then they go back and settle down into those sites again after they've been well mixed. That's why I said it's like Bob Holt's model to a certain extent. At the same fractions, population sizes don't change, but you get the introduction of new genotypes and variation, okay? Oftentimes not consistent with the progress that was made due to selection before the drift, okay? So that's how we incorporate the migration into this model. So we put it all together and we get a complicated mess, but to make progress we did a couple of different things. We made a lot of other assumptions that allowed us to do some analyses. That's what I'm going to talk about here, and we also did some individual base models to see if these had any relevance at all except for the approximations we made. So let me talk about the approximation. Am I already almost out of time? Geez. So we assume that fitness was only weakly sensitive to the traits, and so we could basically take those Gaussian functions or those monotonic functions and approximate them locally by Taylor series. We assume that additive genetic variances were fixed and that the traits were normally distributed. These are key components of Landyland. We also assume that migration was very weak and that the variation in the optimum of the species also varied very weakly. Okay. So this allowed us to get rid of a bunch of terms. But our interest, remember, is in the grand covariance of traits across space. So what we Our goal then was to follow the first and second moments of the distributions of trait means across these different localities. And so that's what we followed. Let me just show you some of the equations here quickly. Here's the equation for the change in the trait mean for species I in a particular site. It has components, at least approximately, due to gene flow. This is selection, and then this is the random component due to drift. Mu here is the spatial mean of all the local mean phenotypes of each species, okay? So that's one of the moments. And so the effect of gene flow then at a particular site depends on the difference between that grand mean and the local mean. Selection, that has this additive genetic variance, and then basically the strength of selection. This is the selection gradient that's due to both biotic and abiotic selection. So I've this is the mean fitness, and the individual fitness is a product of the abiotic and biotic components. If you average them over the normal distribution of phenotypes, that's how you get the mean fitness for a particular species. You do this calculation and you're off and running for drift. And then, of course, drift has no expected value at a particular location. That's also true across different locations because drift occurs independently at different sites. But at any given site, it does have a variance that produces divergence in the means given by the additive genetic variance over the local population size. So using this setup then, we derived dynamic equations for the first and second moments. Okay, so we're making an assumption here also that the distribution of trait means across the environments can be well described by the first and second moments. But there are a lot of these first and second moments we had to consider. We We had to consider the change in the grand mean trait for each species, the change in the variance across space for each species, and then we have these two terms here, which is the covariance between the mean trait for a species and its optimum, which, remember, the optimum phenotypes also vary across space. That measures the degree to which a species is matching its own optimum. But we also had to keep track of the covariance between a species mean and the optimum of the species it was interacting with. Okay, so kind of a cross-species mean optimum covariance. And then finally, and this is the object of most interest, is we also were able to track the evolution of the covariance between trait means. Okay. So this equation is quite complicated here, but it's got components that describe abiotic selection. This is the strength of selection for species one. Here's a factor here that actually describes, for the matching alleles model, the strength of selection on species one due to the biotic interaction. This is the same sort of thing for species two, which also affects the covariance. And then the migration itself mixes up, has a way of breaking down the correlation between the species means, and that's described by this term here. Okay. Notice that there's no component of drift in here at all. The component of drift only contributes to changes in the variance across space of the species means. Okay. And that kind of makes sense because drift occurs independently in different sites, so it shouldn't either enhance or go against any correlations across space. And using these methods, basically, we were able to come up with a couple of analytic results about what would happen for the correlation between trait means across space under the various scenarios. So when fit biotic interactions were determined by phenotypic differences, then what we found basically is that the first and second moments always led to an equilibrium, and at this equilibrium, the covariance between traits across space was at least to this approximation, where epsilon is a small number that describes the strength of migration and weak selection and so forth, was basically zero. Okay? So phenotypic differences never led to, on average, a correlation. In contrast, when fitness consequences of interactions were governed by how well phenotypes match between the species, we could get non-zero covariances and correlations across space given by this term here. But we also found that there were cases where the system never equilibrated. You'd basically have a runaway process where the moments would grow bigger and bigger and bigger. And so those were the two kinds of possibilities when you had phenotype matching. I mentioned that we did individual-based simulations as well to test these kinds, analytic results. And as was nicely described yesterday, the individual-based methods allow you to incorporate a lot of different types of individual behavior, including movement, reproduction, the actual selection, how it's applied. Instead of following explicit multilocus genotypes of the individuals, we used a shortcut for the genetics. We used something called the infinitesimal model, where and I won't go into the details unless people want to hear about it, but it allows you to go beyond this normal distribution of phenotypes that we had to assume in the approximation, but it also allows for speedy computation. So it's kind of a compromise and kept us from going to multilocus genetics. So this individual-based approach then allows us to explore strong evolutionary forces, high migration, and so forth. Okay. So let me just show you some of the results. This is going back to the approximate model. So what kinds of correlations evolve when we have just abiotic selections, okay? Or when we vary abiotic selection. So each one of these graphs shows a different, corresponds to a different strength of abiotic selection in species 1 or species 2. So, for example, this square up here, abiotic selection is set at a strength of 0.01 for both species. And then these axes show the strength of the strength and sign of the biotic selection. So positive values correspond to the species benefits from the interaction. A negative value means it is harmed by the interaction. So if you look in this upper quadrant here, the biotic selection coefficients are positive in both species, so they benefit from a match. That's a mutualism. Down in the lower corner here, you've got competitive interactions since they're both negative, and then the other ones are exploiter-victim quadrants. Okay. So the white area here corresponds to parameter combinations that lead to this runaway, unstable situation. And the rest of the colors here then indicate the sign and magnitude of the correlation that evolves. And so the scale is up here. Blue corresponds to negative correlations. You get them evolving when you've got competitive interactions and maybe a few predator-prey. But by and large, the correlations are red or positive, and they, of course, occur when you've got mutualisms, especially, okay? But also when you have predator-prey interactions. So the red area here shows delimits magnitudes of correlations that would not be statistically detectable if you sampled like 30 different environments. Okay, so the only statistically detectable correlations are outside the area. So there are a number of different things that you can maybe see here is that as the strength of abiotic selection on both species grows, that the range of detectable correlations between the traits shrinks. I mean, this non-statistically significant area here grows in size. Okay, so we're able to make quantitative predictions like that. So what you can see is that in this case, say, there's a lot of interaction and consequences of interactions between these two species, but they would produce, even though there's a lot of coevolution going on, they would produce no statistically detectable correlation. So that confirms Janssen's suggestion that So this shows that even with coevolution, you don't have to have correlation or detectable correlation. We can look at the impacts of genetic drift, which is inversely related to population size. And this is the same sort of pattern. The axes, again, are the strength and sign of the biotic interactions, and we vary the population size that's fixed from 100 to 1,000. Strong genetic drift, weak genetic drift. So what this shows basically is genetic drift can also undermine the relationship between coevolution and correlation. Okay. But it's not necessarily a straightforward way, because if one of the species is very large and not being subject to drift and the other one's small, like in this upper right panel here, you can actually get very strong correlations develop. And I think we're not sure what's going on exactly. This is found in the individual-based simulations as well. But it seems like one of the species, the one with a large population size, is able to respond to the selection quite quickly, even though the other species is moving maladaptively just because of random genetic drift. So you can still maintain a strong correlation there. I think in the interest of time, I'll just move through some of these other graphs. If you look at gene flow, the movement, how does that affect the correlations compared to the previous two panels that I described, you can see that these panels look qualitatively the same. So this suggests then that movement itself, at least the kind of movement we're assuming in this model, does not have a major impact on the size and sign of the correlations. So these describe individual-based models. In the interest of time, I'll move on and just state the main findings and then finish with my open question. So what we found is that in order to get statistically detectable correlations due to coevolution, you need to have the biotic selection be substantially stronger than abiotic selection, and it has to be even stronger when you have these phenotypic differences governing the outcome of selection. And of course, we showed that you can get correlations with no biotic selection at all. This confirms Janssen's hypothesis. But we also found in many, many cases that coevolution does not necessarily imply correlation either. And so that leads us to the conclusion that using correlations of traits among species across space is completely inconclusive about this complicated geographic mosaic theory of coevolution. In other words, you need to use other kinds of evidence to either confirm or refute that theory. So, open questions here relevant to this session. So what we showed here, found, is that fixed random migration, well-mixed migration, seems to have little impact on the covariances between traits of interacting species, the things that coevolutionary biologists are interested in. So one question is, if movement in one or both of the species is adaptive movement or biased movement, would that strengthen either positively or negatively the correlations between the traits of interacting species? So you would need to, of course, build a model that allowed traits to evolve along with whatever movement rules that you modeled as well. And I would say in most cases, mutualism, competitive interactions where you don't get temporal fluctuations, that would lead to the evolution of at least lower migration rates, if I understand the kind of general conceptual theory right. So that, in those cases, migration may actually not necessarily have a different impact on the correlations than what I've shown here, but predator, like exploiter-victim interactions with the potential for dynamic fitness and so forth could lead to higher migration rates, random migration rates, and even context-dependent rules would strengthen or correlations in those contexts. So, I mean, it's an open question as to what effect those kinds of influences on the evolution of migration would in turn lead to these phenotypic patterns where you're out there studying traits. And then, of course, what about the coupled population dynamics? I think Bob described very well in the last talk about this important coupling between the size and dynamics of population size and the strength of selection. So that would, if we included explicit population dynamics in one or both species in the model here, which I've totally ignored, then that would lead potentially to certain situations, maybe predator-prey interactions, where you would see a strong signal, but maybe not in others. So these are this has been a very good workshop for me to try to think about how these effects that I've completely ignored in this study might actually cause some strong differences that are relevant for real populations. So anyway, comments or questions, I'd be happy to try to answer or address. Thank you.